So tonight we'll be looking at Daniel chapter 3. Before we do, let's kind of as a way of review look at some of the questions from the previous lesson, which are on page 16 and 17. First question, who did Nebuchadnezzar call first to tell him his dream? Magicians, astrologers, sorcerers, Chaldeans. What would he know about them if they couldn't reveal his dream?
They agreed to speak lying and corrupt words.
So is that a pretty good test of their abilities? Yeah, definitely. What did the Chaldeans answer the king when he put this forward to him?
That no one can answer.
Only who could answer it?
The gods.
Only the gods.
And they didn't dwell with mortals.
Right. What decree went forth from the king?
The wise men.
And who was that going to include? Daniel and his companions. Okay, question number 5. How did Daniel describe God to Nebuchadnezzar?
Reveal secrets.
Okay. Of what material was the image made in Nebuchadnezzar's dream? First, the head.
Fine gold.
Okay, and who did that represent?
Nebuchadnezzar.
Breast and arms, what was it made out of?
Silver.
Okay, and who did it represent?
Medo-Persia.
Okay, and about, continuing on down, the belly and the thighs?
Brass.
Greeks. And the legs of iron?
Iron.
Legs of iron. I guess I answered my question.
How about that?
Made that one easy, didn't I? Okay. And who did the... What did the stone represent?
Roman Empire. Oh, the stone represented the kingdom. I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah, that one went in there. God's kingdom. I rephrase the next question. Okay. Number 9. What did Nebuchadnezzar say of Daniel's God?
He's the God of gods.
He's the Lord of kings.
Number 10, what positions were given Daniel and his companions? First Daniel, because it's a little bit different.
He's the ruler of the province of Chaldea.
Mm-hmm.
Chief of the governors.
The wise man was out mine headed. And then the others, the companions.
Overseers of Babylon.
Yeah, over the affairs of Babylon. the true false. God gave Nebuchadnezzar a kingdom, power, strength, and glory.
True.
Nebuchadnezzar asked the wise men only to interpret his dream.
False.
Okay. Nebuchadnezzar's dream revealed what shall be in the latter days.
True.
The head of gold represented Nebuchadnezzar.
True.
And Nebuchadnezzar never fell down to worship Daniel.
False.
In verse 46. Okay. So we'll get into the lesson for tonight, which is chapter 3. Story that, you know, we probably all, you know, if we kind of grew up in the church, or probably all, you know, heard a bunch of times, but truly kind of a lesson of their faith and obedience. Let's start.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes, of course.
Because I don't know if you're... I've never thought of it until I was doing this lesson this time. Where was Daniel?
That's a very good question, but I'm going to try to save it to the end so we can get the rest of it, if you'll allow me. Just remind me if we start running out of time, okay?
Okay.
And I'll make sure we hit it, okay?
Thank you.
Because I think that is a fair question, and it's one that a lot of people ask. And I did too, actually.
Okay.
But let's start out. We'll kind of work through the chapter first. Was there any questions from the last lesson? Because I kind of went through the last part kind of quick last time. Okay. We'll go on in. Let's see. If somebody will read for me... Let's read Daniel chapter 3, verses 1 through 7 to begin.
Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces, to to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps and the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the symphony, and all kinds of music, all the people, nations, languages, fell down and worshiped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up.
Okay. So, you know, some of the other chapters we read through kind of helped us get a timeline of when it happened by giving a year of somebody's reign. This chapter does not begin that way. I'm not going to use that because apparently that's not going to work either. Okay. So we don't know. It's not told here explicitly. But the Septuagint records the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. There are some sources that would say perhaps another year, but this seems to be sort of the consensus or what's commonly assumed. That's kind of interesting because this would put it around 580 BC, which was, and I put it up here, around the time of the Third Remnant, which is also when the temple was destroyed. So some people have suggested that possibly this is actually a celebration of subduing Palestine. That perhaps he came back and they built the statue to kind of celebrate, maybe worship his gods, whatever. And so that was perhaps why this was. We don't, you know, obviously we're not told in our passage here, but that's perhaps the day one was done. Okay. The gold image... We're told that it's an image. Some have suggested that perhaps an obelisk, and I'll get to why in just a second. Normally I think that it's some form of one of his gods. Some said perhaps it was him. Certainly pretty much put himself up there. You know, whether he out and out said it or just kind of made it seem like he was a god, but certainly put himself pretty high. But it tells us that it was 60 cubits tall, 6 cubits wide, which is approximately 9 feet by 9 feet. This doesn't fit the dimensions of a person if you actually look at just those dimensions. Got here typically 3.5 to 1 is sort of like our height to width of a typical person. But this is 10 to 1. So what some suggested is that it could be an obelisk, you know, basically more or less a column, you know, and then perhaps it was carved or something. Or perhaps it had a pedestal. So if we kind of try to figure out kind of the dimensions of an image of like a human or something similar, and we assume we could come up with a 50-foot base and 40-foot image. And this is, yes, it's just conjecture, but I think it's interesting to look at. It is interesting to note that there was a statue actually removed by Xerxes that was described as being 40-foot tall. One of the things that I kind of, whenever I first read this, of course, the engineer in me was thinking, that's a big statue or a big image for ancient Babylon, right? I mean, I know they're pretty, you know, high-tech for their time, but that seems pretty big. But the Egyptians actually, 13 BC, had one that was 106 feet tall, an obelisk, if I'm saying that right. Actually, I think it resides across the street from a cathedral or something in Rome now, maybe. But so my other point with this, other than just it's interesting to look at and consider, is that this certainly could have been constructed by them at this time, because obviously, yes?
How tall is the Washington Monument?
I have no idea. History buff, but I don't have a clue about that. Anybody know?
That's for assignments.
So, somebody pull out their smartphone and Google it or something, right? I would suspect taller than that, which actually the Washington Monument kind of looks like an overgrown obelisk. But I'm not sure, but obviously it was quite big. And actually, the way they put these things in, they're actually bigger because there was an actual part that went into the ground that was kind of like a built-in foundation.
555 feet.
So even bigger than that, but it is kind of interesting that the pagan obelisk in Egypt was actually has a big cross on the top of it now. But anyway, my main point, like I said, was somebody might say, well, you know, that's awfully big for a statue of that time, but it was perfectly doable in their time. Yes, sir.
Well, compared to the bigness of it, I don't think today there exists a foundry that can cast all the iron that was cast in the sea with the oxen in front of them. That my mind quit. David's son, mm-hmm. Solomon did, mm-hmm. or had done. This is a toy compared to that.
Yeah.
And of course, the pyramids, who knows?
Well, that's very true. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly. And of course, the thing with this was assuming it was one piece. And of course, they say it was, you know, we're told it's this gold image. Doesn't necessarily mean it was entirely made out of gold. You know, we may say, you know, somebody's wearing a blue shirt or something. That doesn't mean their shirt's made out of blue. You know, we're describing it. But continuing on, depending on what you read, the Plain of Adura could be in a couple of different places. I think Mr. Harris says northeastern thing. I also read
southeast.
Yeah. Okay. He said southeast. I think northwest was another one. But what we do know was it was in a plain. And it was in the province of Babylon, and presumably it had to be somewhere that it could be seen from afar or that a large group of people could be gathered. Because there was quite a few different groups of people mentioned. Okay, as I said, verses 2 and 3, it gives a very long list of all these different, we might just say, sort of all the important officials that were there. Now, we'll get into this later. Well, actually, I'm going to hold off because we're going to talk about the Daniel thing later. But point is, there was all these important officials there, quite a few people. And then the command is given to bow down to this image. And if you think about it, the Jews perhaps were in a unique position here because so many of the nations around, pretty much all of them, were polytheistic nations. They believed in multiple gods and, you know, just another god. So, you know, what's one more? So when you think about it, you know, it kind of helps add to, you know, how unique these three were by not bowing down to it, because the others probably wouldn't have cared. Perhaps they had some problem with that god, but I think that probably would have overridden. Okay. The punishment. First of all, was this a serious sounding punishment? Yeah, just a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Being thrown into a fiery furnace, you know, this wasn't, you know, and what was interesting as I was looking this up was this actually isn't even without precedent. This isn't like, it seems kind of like, you know, well, who comes up the idea of throwing somebody in a furnace? I mean, I know the Romans had some crazy things they did as well, but, you know, what's that?
I mean, this came later.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, that's, who thinks of that, right? But actually, somebody turned over to that Jeremiah passage. This is kind of interesting to me. It just didn't occur to me.
I've got it.
You've got it? Okay, go and read that for me.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, concerning Ahab, the son of Kaliah, and Zedekiah, the son of Masai, who prophesy a lie to you in my name. Behold, I will deliver them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and he shall slay them before your eyes. And because of them, a curse shall be taken up by all the captivity of Judah, who are in Babylon, saying, the Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire, because they have done disgraceful things in Israel, have committed adultery with their neighbor's wives, and have spoken lying words in my name, which I have not commanded them. Indeed, I know, and I'm a witness, says the Lord.
So even there we see, you know, that this was not unusual for that. And the Code of Hammurabi actually had this as a punishment for several things, which kind of surprised me.
One of which was adultery, I believe.
Yeah, one of which was adultery. One of which, I forget the exact wording, but it kind of gave the impression of some, I think, sacrilege, which I'm not sure if dishonoring another god would be considered in that, but perhaps. So there was actually sort of a legal precedent, you might even say, for doing this from his perspective and others at the time. So it's actually, in sort of a gruesome way, kind of interesting to see. So, you know, as I was saying, the Jews, you know, Israelites were kind of, these three were kind of unique in this perspective, that they were being tempted by this at all, in the way they were, besides the fact that obviously being worshiping the one true God. These are some, I've thought of different ways that this could have actually tempted them. Obviously, fear of the punishment. I mean, fiery furnace is going, you know, we're going to be afraid of, you know, any bodily harm. Intimidation, you know, this is a king that just by, you know, being sort of the boss or being the one in charge is going to be a little bit intimidating, right? I mean, if your boss tells you something to do, and the worst thing he can do to you is fire you, right? And even that's going to, they can pressure you a little bit, right? Fear of losing position. You know, they had risen up to have some power, to have a position, perhaps even in their position, a little bit more comfortable than their fellows were. But of course, how did they get to that position? Why were they where they were? Yeah. Exactly. So there's kind of that peer pressure. You know, you've got, I mean, we have no idea how many people are here, but when you've got that many government officials all gathered around, and they're telling you that everybody, you know, oh, peoples, nations, and languages, it's saying everybody's got to bow down this thing. And at least in this one time, there was obviously a lot of people there. And, you know, when in Rome, or in our case, Babylon, you know, this kind of goes the same deal, you know. Well, everybody's doing it. You know, I'm Babylonian official now. And maybe they even said, could have said, well, you know, the statue's nothing. You know, I don't have to give off on the one true God, right?
Well, it's easy to say I'm bowing down, but not in my heart.
Well, yeah.
We rationalize that way sometimes.
Yeah. And couldn't we try to rationalize with all these? Well, you know, obviously I've gotten in this position. God's put me here. You know, surely wouldn't want me to, you know, get killed off this quick, you know. I've been serving and, you know, maybe even doing some good for his people by their positions and everything. And, you know, he is my boss. You know, he is the big guy. You know, I'm supposed to do what I'm told. You know, I'm here. They said, you know, go to Babylon to be saved. And, you know, that doesn't make sense that, you know, I mean, is this, I mean, in a much greater sense, is this any different than a lot of the things we face? Pardon?
That's pretty severe punishment. Yeah. I don't think any of us have been threatened to be thrown in a furnace.
Yeah, it's different. Yeah, it really is. But it's not as though people in our time happen. I think of the girl that stood up out in Colorado with his shoe, and he said, do you believe in God? He had a gun? She said, yes. I think she probably knew.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yeah, the extreme level at which they were faced with this, you know, the types of temptations in some sense, if you take away the punishment, of course you take away the punishment, you take away kind of the whole story, but
we kind of had the same temptations with our jobs, you know, whether or not to speak up about something because we may lose our job or lose position or, you know, mm-hmm. all kinds of things that we may not speak up because we may lose something and not do what's right.
Yeah, so just by the fact that they stood at that one moment, you know, goes so far beyond and sets for a great example as we'll continue on, not to get ahead of ourselves, but to this one point, you know, that last point, statue being nothing, you know, well, I can bow perhaps, and my faith is still the same. What about that passage that I've got listed there? Just straight out of the Ten Commandments, you know, as God was speaking to him, shall no other gods before me, you shall not bow yourself down to them, nor serve them. And if they had bowed down, even thinking that, well, I'm just kind of going through the motions or whatever, you know, wouldn't they have been at that point giving in? Because there's that temptation there, right? You know, if we give into something and we're seen as that, we're just seen as everybody else, right, when we've given into sin. I think it's a great lesson of faith we have here. Okay. So then we go, you know, they apparently not, we aren't told in verse 7, but apparently they didn't bow because we read in verse 8 through the next several verses, they kind of remind, they come up to him and they accuse. They actually also kind of remind of this command that's been put out. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And I didn't get quite far enough. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. So they're saying you're not paying due regard. They're not following your laws. They aren't following you. And it's all the same thing, which, so, you know, you don't respect his laws, you're not respecting him. Which, as a king, probably hit pretty close to home, pretty deep, wouldn't you think? Okay, so continue on the verses. So, it says in verse 13, the Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So he brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you're ready at the time, you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in sympathy with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace, and who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? So, the Nebuchadnezzar, being this just king, says, gives him another chance. Says, is this true? You haven't done this? You know, well, if you'll bow down now, it doesn't matter. You know, first, you know, they've already been faced with this mist of all these people and everything. Well, now the king himself is basically right in their face saying, okay, when this happens, are you going to bow down? So it wasn't just the single moment that they're faced with this temptation. They're facing it again.
And they'll face it again because I doubt the fiery furnace was just sitting there hot.
Well, that's
very, it's going to take some time to get that thing heated up.
Well, exactly. And going right to that point, it wasn't just that it wasn't just good enough for a regular fiery furnace, was it? Before you skip too far ahead, this makes me think of a passage I think we actually mentioned in the first lesson, where Nebuchadnezzar said something that I thought was kind of similar. Do you not know that what I and my fathers have done to all the people of their lands? Were the gods of the nations of those lands in any way able to deliver their lands out of my hands? A little bit, yeah. You know, your God's not any better than my gods. Why don't you call in mine?
I think that was actually Sennacherib, wasn't it?
Oh, it was?
For the time of Hezekiah.
Oh, well, my...
So a few years earlier.
A few years earlier. Okay, well, my apologies.
But it's the same attitude, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah, certainly the same attitude. But yeah, I guess I should have looked a little more at the context. Okay. And I think this is really important. Verses 16 through 18. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. I think what I get out of this that kind of strikes me, you know, did they believe that God could save them? Okay. Do they, in their heads, know that God would save them for certain?
No.
And I think that's really kind of striking to me, because, you know, it's one thing if they had, you know, was still been an amazing show of their faith, but, you know, if they had said, well, you know, I know God's going to save me. But even if he didn't, you know, they believed that he could, but even if he didn't, that wasn't going to change anything for them. And it said that the king's going to know this, that they aren't going to serve this God. Some responses to some trials I was thinking of, kind of to try to, trying to think of some other context, of some other passage where we see other people responding to some trials. Obviously, we ought to obey God rather than men, from a New Testament passage. Job in chapter 13, though he slay me, I will not wait, but I will maintain my own ways before him. He also is my salvation, for an ungodly one shall not come before him. Job, whatever happened, was faithful. Others, you know, had all kinds of awful trials going on, and yet they still believed. Okay. Fiery furnace, just skipping back for a moment for just a little bit of background again or history. The Babylonians didn't have, you know, like furnaces like you would heat your home up. That's not what this is talking about. They didn't have it in the sense at that time. So what they would have had was either an ore smelter for producing their metals or a brick oven. This actually isn't from the time, but from all the historical descriptions, this was actually the best picture I found that I thought kind of described it, because the ore would be dropped in the top, or of course this would be like a smokestack. There'd be a door to retrieve stuff out of. There'd also be perhaps holes to blow air into it to make the fire even hotter, which, of course, it was heated 7 times hotter. And now, does this mean that, say, that oven was 1,000 degrees, that it got heated up to 7,000 degrees?
They put in
10
cords of wood, they just put in 7.
Yeah, I mean, was this, you know,
however they heated it.
Well, notice at the time, of course, what kind of position, what was Nebuchadnezzar's disposition at the time?
He was mad.
He was pretty mad. As a matter of fact, doesn't say he was in a rage. He was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed. Have you ever said something like, you know, wow, you know, it is twice as cold today as it was yesterday? Now, was it now, you know, well, maybe we said that getting up this morning, you know, walking the dog, you know, it's like, you know, and you say, wow, this is like 1,000 times colder than it was yesterday. I am freezing. Well, you know, does that literally mean, you know, that if you say it was twice as cold, then it went from, you know, 70 in the morning yesterday to 35 this morning necessarily? Well, it's kind of an expression, right? You're saying it is a whole lot. Basically, you know, perhaps Nebuchadnezzar was just saying, I want this thing heated up as hot as it can go. You know, just, you know, heat it. I'm not going to belabor the point, but we certainly know that it, I already skipped to the next question, but obviously we know it was pretty hot, right?
It was so hot that it killed the men that took them up. It just came closer to it. Though.
Yeah, exactly. So, however hot it was, obviously they had succeeded in getting it a whole lot hot enough that it was a major, you know, killing machine at that point. And this is important now, but another question I'm going to ask. Okay, so there's a kill. See here. Okay, we'll go ahead and start back in verse 20. And he commanded certain mighty men of valor, who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. And these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So they fell down, either they were tossed on the top or tossed in such a way that they fell down, you know, kicked them in or something. Obviously, if it was hot enough to kill these guys, then they were probably, you know, trying to get them in there quick. Because we've got some other stuff, I'm going to kind of go over this real quick. But obviously, they were falling down in there. They're bound. There's no means of escape. Verse 24 reads, "And Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. And he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, 'Do we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' 'Look,' he answered, 'I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God.'" So does that mean Nebuchadnezzar saw Christ in the fire?
No. Mine's a Son of God.
And that's a very good point. It's also translated Son of God. So several of the translations phrase it that way.
Mine says the gods.
Or the gods. You know, obviously, whatever he saw in there was something different than these three men. That's what we know. And so, and how would Nebuchadnezzar know about Christ? How would he know what he looked like? You know, I think the translation Son of Gods or the word angel is used a couple verses later. I think perhaps is a little bit more apt to what he's saying. The point is, there's somebody else in there that obviously they didn't put in there. Maybe they were thrown in a cold spot. I mean, come on. I mean, they could have been thrown. I mean, surely they're. I mean, you're. I might have been at home. I mean, you may have a cold spot in it. Doesn't yours? I mean,
not very big.
Not a very big one.
I visualize this has to be like a big open pit fire, sort of. The other way I visualize is like a furnace with glass doors, because Nebuchadnezzar can see through. And he can see what's going on inside. And he has to be far enough away from it that he's not burned by it.
Well, obviously there was some door or something, because obviously if they were using it for whatever, there was some way for them to see in. But to say it was thrown into a cool spot, okay, how much sense does that make given the context?
Okay.
Well, they also unbinded themselves, so.
Yeah.
Something
did. I mean, I have a chiminea. When I put it too much in it, the flames shoot out the top and out, coming out at me. I have to be very careful not to put too much in it. So.
And what happened to people throwing them in there? They were killed, right? So, you know. I think it's almost, you know, you have to really be trying and stretching and looking for some way. It's a lot easier just to accept it for the truth, which is that it was a miracle. They were saved. I'm not actually sure. I saw a reference to the series, and I know other people have ventured this before. I haven't actually seen a good excuse for the fourth person, perhaps a reflection or something, I think. That they only saw one of the people twice or something. I don't know. I didn't want to throw that out there, though. Was it just King Nebuchadnezzar that saw him in there? You know, obviously, there were others around, right? That verse 27. And all these people, and it says, "And they saw that these men on whose body the fire had no power, their hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them." That's the part that really kind of striking to me. These guys have been in there. And yet, somehow, they didn't smell the fire, smell of it. You think maybe there was a point being made here? That, they're already being saved from the fire. It's like, as if there was any doubt what had happened to these guys. It's something, you know, not of human power, just happened. The smell of fire wasn't on them. Verse 29, Nebuchadnezzar, there's no other God who can deliver like this. And the three were promoted. Now I'm going to get to your question in the last couple minutes we have here. Oops, I went too far. Okay. Where was Daniel? Daniel was to bow down, right? Because it didn't mention him.
He wasn't in the plain of direction.
Pardon?
He wasn't at the plain of direction.
That's certainly a thing. I've listed quite a few here, all of the possibilities, and there's others, but these are all the ones I could think of or had seen when I was researching that people had thrown out there. First of all, one I just kind of threw out there, well, Daniel may have bowed down. He didn't bow down, but wasn't reported, perhaps because of due to his position. And they'll note that it doesn't say that Nebuchadnezzar bowed. Daniel was in Babylon attending to matters of state. You know, obviously several different ways that he wasn't there, which we have here. You know, grew up in a fairly small town. When they had a parade that everybody was at, you know, there was still a policeman somewhere doing something. Otherwise, every house was probably going to get robbed, right? I mean, you know, we're talking about a massive city here. It's entirely possible he was actually just back in the city. Or that obviously he was somewhere else, like you're talking about, not there, not, you know, he was an official after all. He may have been out of town, as we say, on business. Some would say, well, it doesn't specifically mention some of the miracle worker type people, so perhaps he was exempt. Like I said, perhaps he was away, or he was sick. Okay. And they would also say, well, you know, maybe he didn't, but they just didn't risk challenging him because of his position being tied to Nebuchadnezzar. I think the most likely scenario is that he wasn't there. I mean, I think that's, you know, I don't really see how you can take the rest of the book seriously or take any of it if you can't say that, you know, Daniel, you know, how can you say this faithful Daniel who we have, who bears his name, is on this book? So, like I said, I would say that he was away. If anybody else wants to venture any more evidence of one or the other, go right ahead. By the way, some people know that this might be was an evidence of an earlier authorship. The reason they say that is, you know, here you've got, if this book is written much later and you're writing it as sort of a lesson of faith or something, you know, wouldn't you want to have your star be at one of these major, you know, events in this book? I just breezed through that, but I may have not explained it very well or something either, this part or any part of the lesson. If anybody, we've still got a minute or two, if anybody wants to, has any questions or anything before I perhaps get the questions, but I think obviously the most important thing we can get out of this lesson, you know, there's a lot of great lessons for us. Somebody who's posed with a horrific possibility of being killed for their beliefs, and yet they stood firm in the midst of all this, you know, pressure from different directions and for different reasons. And so I think that's, you know, it's a great lesson for us.
And I guess knowing too the reason why the children of Israel were in Babylonian captivity, it was because of their failing to worship God and worshiping idols. Mm-hmm. That was one of the reasons too. So for those who were faithful, like Daniel and his friends, they'd rather die, as we see here, than to bow down to an idol, which God just detests.
I think what they say is just a huge lesson for us when they're speaking to Nebuchadnezzar directly.
Mm-hmm.
And just, our God is able to deliver us, and he will deliver us from your hand, but if not, let it be known, it doesn't matter, we're not going to serve you anyway. And I think sometimes we like to, maybe not like to, but we sometimes, in our prayers or in our yearnings to God, we ask him for things, and then when it doesn't come out the way we hope or whatever, we blame him. And that's just a